Let's Talk is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to Let's Talk, episode 58, brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network. Howdy, all, Father Corey Stika. Welcome to Let's Talk, our SQPN Community Podcast. Glad you could join us again this week. We've actually got three panelists this week, one of whom is a special guest. But first, Mac Barron is back with us this week. How's it going, Mac?
Hello, Father Stika. How are you doing, Father Stika?
Very good. Mac just found out how to pronounce my name because, you know, I've got one of those names everybody pronounces it, Sticka and Stitcha and who knows, but Mac got it figured out today, so it's a good thing. And Shelly Kelly is also here. How are you doing, Shelly?
I'm doing great, Father. Thanks so much.
And Shelly has a special guest with her as well, Scott Pook. How are you doing, Scott?
Father, I'm doing fantastically well tonight. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, since you haven't, well, Shelly and Mac have been on, but you haven't been on Let's Talk before. Why don't you give a quick introduction so people know who you are?
Well, Father, I'm a space historian, and I'm actually based in Sydney, Australia. I'm over here in the United States following the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. Space has been a passion of mine for over 30 years now. I'm entirely self-taught in this field. And back home, I am a freelance broadcaster, media commentator for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the ABC, and spend a lot of my time speaking on the ABC about the space program of the United States and elsewhere around the world. So it's been a wonderful ride, and it's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Well, we're very much glad to have you. And unlike our friends at Catholics of Oz, you're actually in the United States. You're not in Australia at this moment anyway. So we're not doing the time issue, which is a good thing. We only have the 1 hour. I don't know if you know, Scott, but at SQPN, we have a podcast called Catholics of Oz, and we've got three Australians who are putting that on, Lindsay, Carolyn, and Gerard, and they do an awesome job. And if they happen to be listening to it, maybe they'll get a hold of you and listen to this episode and get a hold of you and maybe have you on there as well.
Oh, that would be fantastic. I'm always happy to be on any podcast or network talking about the space program.
Well, Carolyn especially is a science and astronomy geek, so I think she would very much welcome the opportunity. So hint to our friends over at Catholics of Oz. But you know, of course, as you mentioned, Scott, it is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, and I mean, it was. I've been watching some of the videos and everything, especially when NASA was showing up some of them live, where it was at this moment, this is what was happening 50 years ago, and it's an incredible scene. But of course, the Apollo 11 moment is something that it took years to build up to. What was some of the early preparations that NASA went through to get from just barely doing any kind of rocketry at all to Apollo 11 and beyond?
Well, Father, you're talking about a period of around about 8 years from the time Kennedy committed the nation to going to the moon to the time where we were ready to perform the actual landing. And the build-up during that time was just phenomenal. We went from a period where we were doing what many refer to as a pop gun shot, a 15-minute shot with Alan Shepard, mm-hmm. a suborbital shot, through to the orbital flight of John Glenn. And then we had to have a bridging program, and that was the Gemini program of 1965-66, where we really learned how to work in space, how to walk in space, how to bring two spacecraft together. But then in 1967, we had the tragic setback of Apollo 1, the fire on the launch pad at Cape Kennedy. That took 21 months to come back from, but in that time, we were still doing unmanned flight tests of the Saturn V, the lunar module, and the command module. So by the time Apollo 7 launched in October of 1968, we were confident that the hardware that was in place would be capable of getting us to the moon. but it was a very close-run thing. If anything had gone wrong with Apollo 7, 8, 9, or 10, then the mission profile for that particular mission would be repeated, and the landing could very well have been pushed out to Apollo 12, or maybe we would have missed Kennedy's deadline altogether and gone into 1970. So it was a very rapid build-up. It's something that I don't believe has ever been seen again or at any point in any country's history. It was a magnificent effort by the United States.
Yeah, they took what literally was a fledgling space program and built it into the ability to go land on another planet, nearly our moon, but still.
Look, that's exactly right. And in 1961, we had 15 minutes of spaceflight experience. That all belonged to Al Shepard. Mm-hmm. And many NASA engineers were really confused. How do we do this? How do we go from doing a 15-minute flight where we're not even going into orbit to actually getting a man on the moon? And many thought it impossible even within the space agency. So for them to bridge that gap in that eight-year period, it is just a phenomenal achievement and one that I doubt will ever be repeated again.
Well, and it's probably with good reason that we've kind of come into our lexicon of something that's an almost impossible goal is a moonshot goal. You know,
exactly right. Exactly right. There was good impetus back in the 1960s for that to happen. There was a very strong post-war competition going on with the Soviet Union. They'd already put Gagarin into orbit around the Earth. And we went through this period really until about the first quarter of 1966, where the space program was really playing catch-up. The Soviets would do something, the Americans would catch up to it, the Soviets would pull ahead again, we'd catch up. It wasn't until the joint flight of Gemini 6, Gemini 7 in December of 1965 that things started to swing more towards America and away from the Soviet Union. But it was a politically funded program. It was to be in competition with the Soviet Union. Had it been the way that some of the original rocket designers like Wernher von Braun had wanted, we would have had a space station on orbit first, and we would have used the space station to then go to the moon. I have some publications I hold which show a moon landing not happening until 1990, sorry. And that is publications like Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, really genuine authoritative publications. And yet we did it in 1969.
Well, I heard, and again, this coming actually from Carolyn on Catholics of Oz, had stated that something she'd read basically the day after Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon by the end of the century, he kind of goes, oh, wait, did I just kind of go a little too far there?
Well, that was very much the case. It was the president's science advisor and the vice president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, who really pushed the program for Kennedy. Kennedy himself was probably a little bit reticent to go down that road. And yet the speech he made in front of Congress and then the later speech he did at Rice University here in Houston really polarized the nation and got the aviation companies and the space agency moving in a common direction to make the moon landing goal happen. Once the Kennedy assassination came along in 1963, then there was also this feeling we have to do this in honor of the slain president. And that really kept the impetus going through until we got the landing done. After the Apollo 11 landing, budgets through 1968, 1969 had started to decrease. After 1969, those budgets decreased even further. And we got to the point where the last three Apollo missions, 18, 19, and 20, were all cancelled. And we then moved on to Skylab and then had a six-year period until the shuttle started flying when there was no manned space activity in the United States.
No.
Well, what's interesting is to think about what you just said. I've never heard the idea of some of the impetus and inertia, really, not impetus, but inertia of the space program was to make the late Kennedy's dream a reality. Like, what could have happened if Kennedy had not been assassinated?
If Kennedy had not been assassinated, that's a very interesting point, and it's a real question of speculation. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I believe Kennedy would have served one more term. That would not have got us to the moon landing goal. But would we have been far enough along there in the program that any incoming administration really would not have been able to cancel the program? Right. We've seen that more recently with the original concept for the space station Freedom. Every time a new administration came into the United States, the first instruction to NASA was to redesign the space station. That's what pushed the space station out as far as it did before we got the first module launched in 1998-99 timeframe. Right. Would the same thing have happened with the moon landing? It's an interesting speculation. We could very well have had a moon landing later in the 1970s. We could have stretched the program out further. There was another goal made at the time of the moon landing. The then Vice President, Spiro Agnew, wanted to put a man on Mars by 1980. And that, as history shows, did not happen. And we were probably still about 20 years away from Mars.
Well, yeah, okay. But think about if we had not had the extra wind in our sails.
Right.
Could the Soviet Union had beat us to the moon? I mean,
the Soviet Union was very much relying on their chief designer, Sergei Korolev. Korolev in 1965 died on the operating table. He had a rather basic operation. He had stomach ulcers, which needed to be removed. He had been in very poor health. He had actually spent part of the post-Second World War era in a gulag up in Siberia. He was not a man who was in good health. He had been working basically 24 hours a day with minimal sleep to get the space program in the Soviet Union to the point that it was at. So once his health started to decline and he had to have this operation, he did not have the physical strength to overcome the operation. He died on the operating table, and it was then that we see the succession of Soviet space accidents, Soyuz 1 in 1967, Soyuz 11 in 1971, because he had been the driving force behind the Vostok spacecraft and the early boosters. Once his influence was gone, then the impetus went out of the Soviet space program. They lost really their guiding light in the Soviet Union. And they really did not regain traction. They had designed a lunar lander. There's very good evidence to suggest that some Soviet cosmonauts were training for a flight around the moon, probably in the 1968 timeframe. That was the very much the impetus for getting Apollo 8 off and around the moon in December of 1968. There was CIA intelligence, which showed a large rocket building up on the launch pad of the Baikonur Cosmodrome, that we now know as the N1 moon rocket. The N1 moon rocket was really a technological nightmare. It had 18 separate engines in its first stage. Its plumbing system, compared to the Saturn V that was used here in the United States, was a nightmare. They never managed to fire this thing successfully. Anytime they attempted a launch, the thing blew up and usually obliterated their launch complexes.
Oh, boy.
So with the death of Korolev and the failure to really rekindle what he had put into that program, the Soviets lost their way, and they eventually ended up going simply Earth orbital and doing space stations, which they did very, very well.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the wind in our sails was the space race with the Soviets more than anything else. And then it sounds like coupled with the Soviet space program was getting rather threadbare and desperate. So toward the end of the finish line.
Yes, indeed. And they had a loss in, I believe it was April of 1967, the first Soyuz flight. Now, the Soyuz spacecraft was originally intended to be the craft that would take them to the moon. It's very similar to the Apollo command module in the United States. However, on their very first test flight, Soyuz 1, they send the cosmonaut up into space. He orbits around, but this craft starts going wrong right from the very beginning. They can't lock onto the sun, which they need for their solar panels. The craft is low on power. So they bring the pilot home. He makes what we call a tumbling re-entry where the spacecraft was not controlled. He gets down into the atmosphere. He makes it through the atmosphere, but then the spacecraft's still spinning and the parachute lines tangle. As a result, the spacecraft had no control in the denser parts of the atmosphere, and it slammed into the floor, the hard ground there in the Soviet Union. The spacecraft was destroyed, and the cosmonaut died on impact. That set their program back about 18 months, and then after that, we had the first flight of the Salyut space station. That was coupled with Soyuz 11, and that craft ended in failure as well due to an atmospheric leak on re-entry. So the Soviets really didn't fare well once they got the Soyuz spacecraft flying. Funnily enough, a fourth-generation derivative of the Soyuz spacecraft is what is taking American astronauts to the International Space Station at the moment.
Yeah, that is kind of funny where they've gotten to that point, basically the Apollo level of technology, but they weren't able to make the step beyond that.
Yes, indeed. The craft, I saw one in London a couple of weeks ago, one of the new generation craft, and I compare it with an older Soyuz that I've seen elsewhere, actually in the United States, here in Kansas, and they're internally, they're not altogether different. All they've done really is put in digital displays and maybe change their guidance system a little bit. It's still fundamentally the same spacecraft that Korolev designed for them before his passing, but it's really been an ongoing effort over the last 50-odd years to get this craft to a level of reliability. So the Soviets, I would assume, the Russians will continue to launch that craft well into the 21st century because they have no other viable option.
Well, I just want to pause the lesson here for just a second and say, yes. Shelley, I want to address you here. The next time we ask for an expert on a subject, we want an expert, okay? None of this dilettante crap.
When you said that the space program in Apollo 1 would be our topic tonight, I said, oh, how serendipity.
Yeah, this is phenomenal. We really appreciate this.
This is fantastic. Are you kidding me? This is amazing.
No.
All right, so can I ask, what got you into this?
Well, I was a 12-year-old boy.
I was too. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
My friend, we are joined. How's that?
Yeah.
I'm not only Australian, I'm a very, very proud Tasmanian. I'm from the island state of Tasmania. And I could give you the date. It was the 11th of April, 1981, in Australia. I was watching the network I now freelance for, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And they showed a picture of this weird airplane-like thing strapped onto what looked like a rocket. And being a 12-year-old, I thought, oh, that's never going to work. There is no way that this will ever fly. I persuaded my mother to let me stay up and watch this thing fly. Of course, it didn't. The launch was cancelled. Two nights later, up this thing went. I didn't see it live because my mother wouldn't let me stay up after 8 o'clock at night. But when I saw it and I watched it back over the coming days, I was just absolutely blown away by what I was seeing. The notion that this airplane, which is what it looked like to me, was going to orbit 200 kilometers above the Earth. And I always remember April the 15th it was. I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, which in Tasmania is a very, very dark time of day. There's no daylight. And the ABC had a news flash before they started their programming. And here we see this airplane, the Columbia, coming down, landing on the runway. And that was the beginning. For the first couple of years, it was space shuttle landings that fascinated me. And then I heard a recording of Apollo 8 going around the moon and the first descriptions of the moon. And at that same time, the Space Shuttle Challenger flew its first flight, and the astronauts on that flight did a spacewalk. And you see the astronauts out in the payload bay, and you've got a half Earth going over the top of the payload bay. And as somebody with very deep connections into the church, that was it for me. The seeing the fragility of the Earth, seeing these two astronauts out there in the payload bay, and also having the Apollo 8 recording going in my mind. That was the beginning. I thought I'll only ever really be interested in the space shuttle and, you know, these moon landing things, as it was at the time for me. 30-odd years later, here I am on my 8th tour of the United States. I have quite a sizable archive of about 1,500 books in my office in Sydney, and I'm working all over the world doing what I love. It's been a magnificent ride, and I'm sure it's still got a way to go.
So absolutely. Your career is what exactly?
Well, I'm a combination of things. I'm a trained librarian, but I'm
woo-hoo,
now
me too.
Wow, more bonding.
Oh my gosh, can you drive a car?
Well, here we go. No, I can't. I'm actually medically disqualified in my country.
Oh, bummer.
So that well, hey,
you still have both testicles. Is that it? Is that the thing?
That's the thing. But here's the thing. I have actually covered on Greyhound buses 31,000 kilometers in this country.
Oh, wow.
I keep telling you need to be a spokesperson for Greyhound.
Shelley, that's an accomplishment.
That's an accomplishment.
This dude is not going to purgatory. He has done his time.
Yeah, exactly.
On the Greyhound.
Yeah, try doing an overnight on Greyhound from Huntsville, Alabama, up to Washington D.C. with one stop. That's serious commitment to a cause, right there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, go ahead.
So how did you and Shelley end up getting connected with all this?
Well, I'm going to let Shelley answer that question.
So I was working in a library because I'm not a trained woo-hoo! Librarian. I'm a trained archivist. I'm a certified archivist. And at the time, I think it was your 2003 trip.
2002.
Was it 2002? Okay.
It was indeed.
So in 2002, I was working at the University of Houston Clear Lake. We had a Space Act agreement with the National Archives and with NASA's Johnson Space Center to house their early space history collection. And this was largely records that could have been in the Federal Repository in Fort Worth, but they were on site so that engineers at Johnson Space Center could continue to reference the material in them as they were moving forward with International Space Station and now even Orion and some of the current NASA spacecraft. And Scott was just one of our many researchers who came in. When you came in, I was probably under a year on that job. And as you know, it's he's an easy guy to like. You get to know him. He was staying in that youth hostel up by the museum district.
I was indeed.
And somehow you talked me into dropping you off and picking you up from the long-term bus park and ride. And so we got to be friends and have been friends ever since then. The next trip, I think you spoke to my daughter's preschool class, the one who's now in college.
Yes.
And then the next trip, you spoke to my other daughter's preschool class. And he's spoken actually to a number of elementary school classes about Australia, not space, because we lived in space territory. Everybody knew an astronaut. Everybody knew an astronaut's kids. My next door neighbor was an astronaut. We knew multiple people who worked in mission control or in some building somewhere. And so they didn't want to hear you talk about space. They wanted to hear your accent and describe a Tasmanian devil.
And I actually bought a stuffed toy Tasmanian devil over with me on both those trips, both of which are still here in Houston. So,
and book. And we've stayed friends all of this time. And I think it was in 2011, you came down for the first time. I invited you into my home for dinner. And lo and behold, he and my husband became like best buds.
Awesome.
BFFs forever. To the point that here we are now, Scott stays with us on some of his trips. And when you arrived last week, Brian said, hey, we drove past Stennis in Mississippi. Have you ever been there? And you said,
no, I have not.
And my husband said, road trip. So now Scott has been to Stennis, Mississippi.
And that completes my set of NASA space centers. I've visited everyone in the United States, but there is one thing else I should share with you. I got married in 2016. And we made it a truly international wedding. We streamed the whole thing out on Facebook Live. But Shelley and her family provided the prayers for my wedding. We did videos of them and sent them down, batched them down to Australia, and we actually played them live in the church. And Shelley and her family were watching live here in Houston. So it was wonderful to have the Kelly family link with my own for that very special time in my life.
Oh, that's awesome. That's
okay, I have two questions.
Yes, indeed. Right.
One, this is going to be difficult for you to answer, but I want you to give it a go, okay?
I give anything a go.
I'm getting that impression. All right. Is the Australian accent in the United States more useful and or charming than an American accent in Australia?
Well, I'm naturally charming anyway, so that goes without saying.
Point well made. Touché.
It's interesting. If I really need to get things done over here, I can't tell you the amount of hotel upgrades I've gotten simply by opening my mouth and talking. A lot of people pick me as South African. I've had New Zealand, which for an Australian, a Southern Australian, that's bad. That's bad.
That's great insult.
Like calling back a Yankee.
But people in America are fascinated by the accent. I don't feel I've got one, but other people listen to me and tell me I do have one.
Yeah, it's slight. It's subtle.
Just like you there, Mac, you know, I don't have an accent because I'm a Midwesterner. You know, us Midwesterners, we have like the perfect sure. accent, supposedly. But of course, God there's like Mac you. In the South there.
One thing I can say is if I have American people come over to Australia, I can pick what part of the United States they're from, probably because of the amount of time that I've spent here.
Mm.
And I have about a 90-95% success rate. I think it's only the far northeast, up Boston and further points north that I haven't been to that I can't usually pick. But most of the time I get it and I get it right.
Yeah.
Okay, so this brings up a wonderful, wonderful point about there are levels to Southern accent that you have to take away urban areas. Okay.
Yes.
Because you get too far into an urban area in the South and you lose the Southern accent.
Everybody goes
so
there.
You drive off in the country and you go down a couple of latitudes and it gets thicker and thicker and thicker, right? All right. So I was wondering, is it this, you have the same phenomenon in Australia? Because I have a good friend who is from, gosh, I've forgotten the name of the town, but you know how Australia kind of has like a crack in the South? He's from a town in the tip of that crack.
So he's from South Australia area?
Yeah, but he doesn't. It doesn't sound as thick as yours. So.
Oh, if he's from South Australia, oh damn! It's interesting because I'm from the island state of Tasmania. Now I should point out we are the true down under because you've got to go down and then underneath to get to us. So we are the true down under, not this other lot. the further north you go, my heritage is that on my mother's side, I'm Aboriginal and South Sea Islander. And my mother's family are the traditional landowners of the Great Barrier Reef and the Whitsunday Passage in Queensland. So if I was to have one of my cousins here now and have them talking, you'd hear a very different accent to what I'm giving you now.
Sure.
Which cousin?
The cousins from Queensland, the Aboriginal and Islander, because North Queensland, even within the state of Queensland, it's such a vast area. It's like the state of Texas. It just keeps going.
Mm-hmm.
the accent from northern Queensland, where they are, to the accent in Brisbane, about 3,000 kilometres away, is very, very different. And then if you come down to me in Tasmania, another 3,000-4,000 kilometres south, the accents are once again different. If you go to Western Australia, oh, we don't even know what they're saying over there because, you know, you've got the desert and the outback between.
Okay, my other question was...
Yes.
When I was about 14 years old, the only thing I knew about Australia was, one, taught to me by Crocodile Dundee, and two, the movie The Howling Part 3. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's werewolves in Tasmania is really what it is. That is what Tasmanian devils are. They are, in fact, werewolves, according to this movie. I realize it's not a historic document.
Well, it's interesting because Tasmanian devils come out at twilight and they're mainly heard right after daybreak. And if you're not ready for them, they will scare you.
Mm.
They don't look like the Warner Brothers character. They look like an oversized cat, but they snarl, they spit. They're our state animal, but you wouldn't want to cuddle one. No. As for Crocodile Dundee, let me tell
you. Like you're describing my wife. Go ahead.
let me tell you, Paul Hogan, who acted the main role in Crocodile Dundee, do you know how he got his start?
Mm.
I do not.
His original job was he was a rigger and painter on the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Mm.
And he was telling jokes and funny stories to the other riggers on the bridge. And they said, hey, you got talent. Maybe you should do a live show. So he started doing clubs around Sydney. And then he got picked up by the Channel 9 network in Australia and started doing a national comedy show back in the 1970s. That then progressed onto the Croc Dundee franchise of films. So he has a link with one of our national mechanical icons in the form of the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And so, how do you feel about Crocodile Dundee?
Well, I spend quite a bit of time in the outback when I'm back home, and Shelley will tell you I've got an Australian slouch hat here with me at the moment, so when I'm dressed properly, I actually resemble him in a very big way. But the outback as portrayed in the film, we don't have a lot of people wrestling crocodiles. I must admit, I've never done it. I
don't mind telling you, that's very disappointing.
Well, I have had too many close encounters with our snakes. We have some of the most venomous snakes in the world down there.
I'm from Georgia. Go ahead.
And the longest snake I've had, I don't know how to put it in American measurements, but it was on the order of 5 meters long. And this is the most venomous snake in Australia. You get bitten by this thing, don't even go to the hospital. You're not going to make it to a hospital.
Is that the black snake?
It's an eastern brown snake.
Mm.
Yes. We have been chased by snakes in our car.
So 5 meters. 5 meters, that's like 14 feet.
14, 15 feet. A meter is about 3 feet, give or take.
It's slightly less. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow.
This thing was, I've never seen anything so big. I didn't stand around to take in its true grandeur and beauty. I decided it was best to retreat. I didn't realize I could run up hills like they have in San Francisco as fast as what I did that day.
Yeah.
So I never want to have that sort of experience again, but this thing was a true monster.
Wow.
But they're not uncommon, particularly in the mountainous areas of the Snowy Mountains and the Great Dividing Range. You'll find them. So you have to watch where you put your feet or otherwise it could be a very bad day. You're either going to get bitten by a snake, you might have a kangaroo who doesn't particularly like you too much, or you might have a koala bear drop on you. So Australia's a very dangerous place.
Yeah. I've never seen a kangaroo in real life. I hear they're much larger than what one just assumes they are. Like they can be like 7 or 8 feet tall. Is that right?
That's correct. The big red kangaroo, you get these mainly in the outback. I've encountered them out there a few times with my NASA research, and they...
that may have never been said in the history of mankind. Those red kangaroos in the outback, I've encountered them several times in my NASA research.
Well, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. The reason being is one of NASA's original tracking stations was in a place called Island Lagoon, which is 25 kilometres to the south of Woomera in the very northern part of South Australia. So we are in the true outback out there. And I went out there in 2014 to locate this. This is a station that closed in 1972. I headed out there in 2014 to find the remains of this station. So I'm trying to find something that hasn't existed for 30-odd years in the outback where you don't really see anything. And my one instruction was to look for a telephone pole. To look for a telephone pole. I found the telephone pole, but I also found this big red kangaroo who came out from behind the only tree, stood in front of our car, which was a Mazda 3, which you all have over here, and he reared up against the car. Now, if it's a Mazda 3 and a big red kangaroo, my money's on the big red kangaroo.
Yeah.
But he came out, he looked at us, he took a step towards us, then he went back behind the tree, and we drove past. But every time we drove in or out of that site, the kangaroo would come out from behind the tree, sit in the middle of the road, and look at the car. And we ended up dubbing him the gatekeeper of Island Lagoon.
That's funny.
He may have had some kind of relationship with that telephone pole.
Yeah, he might have, because they looked about the same size when you're in the car.
That's so apparently Mac has never met an Australian and wants to know everything about Australia.
I love it. It's so charming to me. Everything about it. And as a kid that grew up in, I don't know if you're aware of it, but from about 1984 until about 1989, America had a real love affair with Australia. And there were several pop culture figures that I'm sure Australians were entirely embarrassed by, but Americans could not get enough of. Crocodile Dundee. There was that Energizer Bunny guy, the Oi guy, who ended up on some television show where he's driving some futuristic 18-wheeler. Yeah. I don't even remember. Do you remember that?
Well, he was, I know the person you mean. I could see him in my mind's eye. He is actually one of our top Australian Football League footballers from that time period.
Okay.
What he's doing now, I assume he's still powered by Energizer batteries, but
he's God blessing.
He was Mark Jackson was his name, and he was a huge figure in Australia as well. But he promoted a lot of other things at home apart from batteries.
Gotcha. Well, that was a very formative time in my life. All right, so Father, you had I think kind of posited the idea of us kind of going around and talking about what the space program meant to us.
Yeah,
that's right?
I was trying to do it, but you kept going to Australia instead of the space.
Well, I can understand that. It's a good place to go to.
Exactly. By the way, I would love to get down there to visit Australia someday. My folks went on a week tour, mostly Sydney, Melbourne, that area, and just absolutely loved it.
Well, I'm based in Sydney now and am looking to move back to Tasmania probably within months, but I've been in Sydney for 25 years. It's been a good city to me. Loved it. Yeah. Highly recommend it to anyone who's listening on the podcast. Come on down.
Fantastic. So, Mac, why don't you mention, you kind of grew up in the 80s, kind of about the same time I did. What was the space program? How was it in your life?
The space program, the ever-present symbol of it was the space shuttle.
Yeah.
Now, to a young man that spent every summer day watching some variation on the Star Wars franchise or a cheap knockoff, the space shuttle seemed like a hand-me-down version of what I saw in the movies, which I'm sure that's always the way it is. Science fiction is always way ahead of the curve. So it was the space shuttle, and I thought it was cool. And really, I don't remember knowing about the moon landing until I was 11, which I think is sin. Like, I look back at my parents and think, you guys are great people, but I, man, landed on the moon, you know? And as the older I get, the more recognition I have or understanding of just what an amazing accomplishment that was. And mm-hmm. we haven't done anything like it since. So, I guess the short answer is space shuttle. And I kind of knew there was a moon landing. And yeah, I was too young to appreciate what a freaking incredible thing that was.
Mm-hmm.
And I would catch glimpses of the right stuff. And as a like when I was like 10 or 11 years old, and it wasn't entertaining enough to hold my attention, but I would see like the space clips and stuff. And speaking of Australia, there's this beautiful scene of one of the astronauts in orbit, and it kept showing like Aborigine, like lighting fires, and it would show like these sparks in space. And as a little kid, like I couldn't wrap my head around that. Like, they're not the same spark. They can't be the same. Like, I didn't have any idea of what the filmmaker was trying to say.
The symbolism behind it.
The symbolism and the connection to Earth and the beauty of it. I did not get that as a child. So it was just this unapproachable thing almost from the right stuff.
Sure. How about you, Shelley? Of course, you kind of talked about it a little bit, but.
As I mentioned, I grew up in Houston, so I really don't remember a time when we didn't know about the space program. I can't remember a summer we didn't go down to walk around on the Johnson Space Center campus. And in those days, you didn't need a pass, didn't have a visitor center, you didn't need a badge. I can remember going into the cafeteria and stopping by the little gift shop in the corner and picking up, I think it was the early 80s, we picked up a book called The Light Stuff, and it was a series of anecdotes and humor. I think you have it, don't you, Scott?
Do.
Yeah. And so it just was. My best friend in high school, her aunt, I think, was worked at NASA, worked for one of the contractors. She works there now. So you just did. And I lived in different places, went to school, moved to Galveston Island. And then when I took the job in 2001, it was like coming home. You start to learn more and more about it, and then you get to know your neighbors. And I always marveled ever since I moved away from that area that everything there worked so seamlessly. The lights are all timed well. The water authority is well run and perfectly managed. And then I came out to where I live now, and everything's kind of a mess. And I'm like, man, what gives? What, we have it so good back there? And it turns out, well, it is rocket science. I mean, they are rocket scientists. So, I mean, of course they've got it all figured out. But there's a couple of different events that I know you didn't mention, Mac, and I'm sure we all know where we were. And those were the tragedies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not to take away from the celebration here of Apollo 11 and what our big accomplishments are. But as Scott has mentioned, sometimes it is through our failures that we are able to achieve greatness because we've learned from those mistakes. And I'm about the same age as you, Merrick, and Scott. We're all about the same age. So
25?
We're probably all in the, yeah. We weren't in high school when the Challenger exploded.
I was in my fourth grade cafeteria. We were having lunch when they came in and told us the shuttle had exploded.
You were in the fourth grade?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I was in high school. But the one that really, really hit home was the Columbia. Because it was our neighbors, because it was our friends at church. They were our parishioners. They were our people. And I'm not going to talk about that right now, but that was a very powerful moment that I'm glad I experienced. But I've just had so much fun watching, especially through you, Scott, the 50th anniversary. I'm not involved in it like I was during the 40th, but I've had so much fun watching. The biggest trick for me is seeing how some of our friends have aged, realizing that these men are now in their mid to late 80s, not the 70s. So that part's been fun.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, because what we're seeing now is we're seeing a changing of the guard. As Shelley said, a lot of the Apollo astronauts in their 80s and 90s, Frank Borman, the commander of Apollo 8, he's, I believe, 94 or 95 years old now. So we are seeing these old guard go away. We've just, in the last week or so here in Houston, had the passing of Christopher Kraft, who was the father of Mission Control. He really came up with the Mission Control concept. And from a historian point of view, this loss of these men is huge because we're losing the capability to get firsthand accounts of what it was like to fly these missions, what it was like to design these craft. And mm-hmm. as we go forward, we're really relying on their recorded histories, their oral histories and other to yeah. gain insight into what it took to put together the Apollo Command Module, or the Apollo Lunar Module. The work that Shelley was doing at University of Houston was instrumental to that in bringing all that material together and making it into a repository mm-hmm. where archivists and engineers and people such as myself can go and get that firsthand testimony. We are getting to a stage where we no longer have that. There are some of the right. Apollo crews, Apollo 12 and 14 come to mind straight away, where there are no longer living members of those mm-hmm. crews. They have all passed away.
Right. Yeah, and that's, I mean, it is a wonder, though, that we have the technology that we've had in the last 50 years where a lot of this stuff is recorded, you know, audio, video, books. We have the resource we can hear about. And, of course, we do still have materials from the moon landings. We still have the rocks and things like that, you know, and some of the artifacts from it. But, yeah, I'd heard that NASA had erased the actual tapes of the moon landing. The only copies of the moon landing we have, the video of it, are from TV recordings, not from NASA itself.
Well, that's exactly right. The ABC in Australia actually has recordings that came into the Honeysuckle Creek Station south of Canberra. That's where the first 8.5 minutes of the walk were broadcast from before the signal switched to Parkes. Now, in Australia, we actually saw the moon landing about 30 seconds before anybody in America because the ABC put out a direct feed instead of sending it on to the United States. They also routed it out through their television network. What is also in existence is a number of about 20 minutes worth of footage that was recorded at the Honeysuckle Creek Station. Now, this was recorded by Videotech holding a Super 8 movie camera.
Oh, sure.
Up to the monitor as the picture came in, and it actually shows a clearer resolution of Armstrong stepping onto the moon. And he also managed to capture about 20 minutes after NASA cut the picture once the crew were back inside the lunar lander. So you actually see the backpacks getting pushed out onto the lunar surface. It's wow. quite incredible footage to see, and it is clear as clear. The BBC got hold of these films and has now recorded them to archival quality. They're quite something to see.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, I'd love to see that. It's just it's kind of funny, though. But yeah, it's hard to think that we're at that point now where we're going to the next generation. But you know, you talk about, like, Mac, you talk about your experience with the space program. I'm kind of I'm about the same age as you are, Mac. And so I grew up watching the space shuttle, and I loved watching the space shuttle. I was into science. I was into space and astronomy so much as a kid, you know, rushing home to watch the launches, because usually the launches were kind of in the afternoon. So, you know, I could get home from school a lot of times and watch the launches themselves or watch like the replay on the news or something like that. And so, you know, I saw the Challenger explosion, you know, as it happened and stuff like that. But when the Discovery first went up, got to see that at the school. They actually broadcast that at the school when this Discovery went up after the Challenger explosion. So that was also pretty incredible. But it's interesting, though, you know, talking about where the space program has gone from Apollo 11, because, like you said, Scott, it really went into a lull for a long time, other than doing, you know, unmanned launches for satellites and things like that. We just had the space shuttle. And, you know, for my pick, it's going to be, you know, where I think the space program is going in the future. But what's your thought of where the space program is going now? And I don't mean just NASA, by the way. I want to make sure that gets clear, too, because there's other space programs out there that are doing more.
Can I ask about, before you get to the future, I have one more question about the past. And
yes,
and
indeed.
It's gonna sound silly, but I mean it literally. Like, Australia. Is there an Australian space program?
It's interesting you mentioned that. Our federal government in the last budget for 2018-19 actually programmed in $60 million to begin a national space agency in Australia. We have had launch capabilities for quite some time out of the Woomera base in South Australia. England and the Europeans were using that back in the 1970s. It's now fallen into disrepair. But this space agency that's coming along, it'll be centred in Adelaide in South Australia, and it's really designed to do space research. The Australian people, when this announcement came out, thought, wow, right, we're going to have our own spacecraft. We'll be putting our own man into space. We are not there yet. We are a very long way away from that. The other role that we've played in Australia is that, as I alluded to earlier with Honeysuckle Creek and Island Lagoon, we have played a major role in the American program from the very beginning by hosting NASA tracking stations for unmanned and manned spacecraft. We currently have the Tibbenbillis station operating south of Canberra. That keeps in contact with the Mars rovers, the Voyager spacecraft, any unmanned spacecraft that's out there. And that is one of the major three stations in the Deep Space Network. So for Australia, I see the future just going ahead in leaps and bounds, providing the government continues to support the space agency in its fledgling form. Sure. As to where we're going for the future of space in general, I'm like everybody else. I see a Mars landing coming up, but I don't see it as early as some people. I'd put it into the 2030s. I believe that it will be an international collaboration, very much as the International Space Station is at the moment. But I will say one other thing, and that is watch the privateers, particularly SpaceX. The stuff that Elon Musk is doing is just mind-blowing. And to be able to harness the technology that he has of having the flyback boosters, which can land on a predetermined point, then you can use those boosters again. He's dragging his launch costs down, and every time you do that, it makes launching just that much more available. And I see a private moon mission as a very, very real possibility. I believe that may happen before an international moon mission. So far advanced is Elon Musk with his technology.
Oh, sure. Well, absolutely. Well, this is a good place, I think, to take a break before we go on to our picks of the week. Good place to stop and thank everyone for listening to Let's Talk and all our SQPN podcasts. We're glad you enjoy our shows and you're listening to them. And I hope you're sharing them. I encourage you to share them and to like them on Facebook and YouTube and give us comments. We obviously love to hear what you think of these shows, whether this one or Catholics of Oz or Secrets of Star Trek, Secrets of Doctor Who, and so on. And we definitely want to hear your feedback. We also want to thank those who support SQPN. Of course, like many organizations, we need money to keep these podcasts coming. And so we really thank especially our Patreons, those who join our Patreon campaign, sqpn.com.give is where you can find that. Especially we'd like to thank our patrons by name, Linda N., Janet M., Sam E., Eric E., and Brian S. Thanks to you, and thanks to all of our Patreon patrons for your support in keeping our shows on the air. So we'll go ahead now to our picks of the week. And Scott, as our special guest, why don't you go first and tell us about your pick?
Well, where do I start? I've had such an incredible experience on all of my United States trips, but my pick, I've got to tell you, I, as Shelley said, drove back from Stennis in Mississippi the other day, and I am constantly amazed as I go around America at what I see. And this one left me speechless. My pick would have to be this place called Bucky's, which we have here in Texas. And it is, I walked into this place. I didn't believe it. I've been told about it, and its mascot is Bucky the Beaver. So I encourage anybody, if they're in the state of Texas, you've got to stop by one of these places. I am taking back to Australia a Bucky the Beaver.
That's awesome.
So if anybody's passing through Texas, going along I-10, there is one in Baytown on the edge of Houston. Go and take a look at this place. You will not believe it.
You know, those are invasive species. I don't know if they're going to let you through customs.
Well, on one of my earlier trips, I actually took back a stuffed version of the Roadrunner and had him sticking out the top of my backpack. The person at passport control looks at my passport and he says, okay, which of you two does this apply to? So I shouldn't have any trouble getting Bucky in there.
What is, you got to help me out. What is Bucky? Is it a bar?
I'll let Shelley answer that one.
Is it a, well, like Trader Joe's? What is?
No, it's like the ultimate gas station road stop. And there's actually one in Alabama now, just on the east side of Mobile.
Okay.
Gulf Shores.
Right.
Maria Johnson. I don't know if she's had the pleasure of stopping there yet, but she knows it's there. I know we've talked about it. So, but you go in, it's huge. I think the largest one, I don't know where it is, but it has something like 100 to 120 gas stations, pumps for, wow, your gas station. And they pride themselves really on having the largest, cleanest bathrooms in Texas. And they're amazing. I mean, you rarely have to wait. And it's super crowded. And there are times you can't even get into the gas pumps. And then there's side parking and there's RV parking. And when you go in, there's probably, 10,000 square feet of shopping. And you have a whole deli counter and the pecan logs and the cinnamon nuts. And fudge, and you can buy ready to go made barbecue sandwiches or deli sandwiches. You can place an order and wait for them. They have clothing. They have lots of Bucky branded apparel.
We just call those malls.
Really good coffee. But yeah. This is all in like one great big place. You can get deer corn for your feeder. You can get artwork. You can get, I mean, it's a unique experience, as Scott can tell you.
Now, for an Australian where you go to a gas station in Australia, you've got four pumps and a tiny little shop that might sell you a meat pie, a Bucky's is a huge revelation.
We could just get meat pies. That would be amazing.
Yeah, no kidding. Yes,
barbecue and meat pies.
Oh, wouldn't that go well together?
Ooh, yes. With an icy.
Oh, yes.
And if I'd known you wanted one of those Bucky Beavers, I would have sent one to you.
I'm sure you would have.
Because you gave us the Tasmanian Devil.
Yeah, two of them.
So, Shelley, why don't you give us your pick here while you're...
Well, I keep going back and forth in my head. There's a new SQPN podcast called American Catholic History that I love. And I play it every time there's a new one, I play it. And there needs to be more. But then as we were talking, one of the things that you said about how I think, Scott, you mentioned that now that we're seeing the passing of the original guard, how we're losing some of that institutional memory. And I want to call out that there is a Johnson Space Center oral history collection, and it's been in wide use. The originals are housed at the University of Houston Clear Lake campus, but they are available also in transcript form online. And you can go and search. I don't have the URL handy, but if you search JSC History Collection Oral Histories, you can find them, and you can hear or you can read the words of Max Faget, who is our capsule designer for the American Space Program. You can read about the space shuttle development. You can read about the development of the heat shield by Alec Bond. You can listen or read about the astronauts, Sally Ride, Guy Bluford. You can hear the words or read the words of Glenn Lunny, who was our Apollo. He was an Apollo mission controller, flight controller. He was also our Apollo Soyuz space project program manager. There's so much you can learn from the past and learn from what they did from a business perspective, from a space and science perspective, from a human perspective. And it's all captured and available. It's not the same as talking to them face to face, but it's a good foundational groundwork to begin your research.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. That sounds very interesting. Definitely have to check that out. Mac, what you got for us?
All right, boss. I got two.
Uh-oh.
One is because we're talking about Apollo, the Apollo 11 landing, and I need to do a mea culpa that I completely dropped the ball as a parent of seeing this thing on the horizon and exploiting it, because at least one of our sons has some sort of strong connection, some sort of fascination, the moonshot that I need to exploit more. But what did get me, or the anniversary got me into a podcast, a limited series podcast called Apollo 11, What We Saw. And it's done by Esoteric Media, is what it's called. Esoteric Radio Theater. And it's hosted by a chap named Bill Whittle, which is apparently, yes?
He's a political analyst usually, but yeah.
Yes, I have absolutely no experience with this cat outside of this podcast, but he is clearly someone that, like you, sir, got the bug rather early in life and has been fascinated with the space program all his life, and you can tell the passion. He wrote the thing, even though it's produced by some others, it is really wonderful, and it is a very, very good primer. It'll make you think you're an expert on it until you speak to someone like yourself. And it is very entertaining and done with it. Wonderful the way he talks about those commie bastards that we are constantly trying to outrun in the space race. It's really funny the way he brings that sort of emotional American baggage to it. It's awesome. The other one, so that's Apollo 11, what we saw. The other one is a show that was recommended to us by a listener. We do a podcast called Catholic in a Small Town, in case no one's ever heard of that. But one of our listeners recommended a show to us from the BBC called Miranda. And Miranda Hart, apparently, is a famous comedian in Great Britain. And I think it's from 2009, and it's a standard British sitcom, but with a very tall, slightly mannish, pratfalling young lady at the helm, she's hilarious. It is genuinely funny and genuinely charming and a little bit naughty. And what's funny is any listeners to our show heard me gush about a show that's on Netflix called Fleabag.
Mm.
And you can clearly see the DNA of this show in that show, whereas Fleabag is a sort of sophisticated version of almost the same concept, except without all the darkness and the silly British humor infused in it. And so Miranda is the name of that show. We're watching it on, I think it's Hulu. Could be Netflix. I think it's Hulu, but Catherine and I are enjoying that. We've seen two whole episodes, and it's delightful.
Excellent. Excellent. Another thing to check out. Well, my pick is actually something Scott mentioned earlier. You know, you mentioned SpaceX and the stuff that they're doing. And my pick is the SpaceX YouTube channel, because they have, well, I mean, first of all, everybody saw the Starman where Elon Musk said, hey, we need this weight to test the Falcon Heavy rocket. Let's throw my original Tesla Roadster into it and launch it into a space with a spacesuit in it. And they did. And they broadcast it on the internet. And every launch they do, they broadcast it live, where you can sit and watch everything that's going on from liftoff to, you know, stage separation to landing. You know, you can watch
with
them.
Commentary. They'll tell you
commentary.
What's
exactly. Right. Yeah. And they have video on the rockets, so that it's up, you know, 10,000 kilometers or whatever, you know, it's way up there, and you're still watching live video of this mission, and including, though, I just watched one the other day where they had a camera on the outside of the stage one coming back, and you're watching the Earth get bigger, 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 and all of a sudden the thing just, you see the rocket fire, and it just hits the brakes, and whoop, almost like, you know, wouldn't put a ripple in the pond when it touches down. You know, and what just for me, again, knowing some of the history of science, kind of like what we talked, or of space, kind of what we talked about here, and growing up in the 80s into the 90s and 2000s, where the space program wasn't the most exciting. SpaceX, with what they can show on YouTube and what they're doing with the landing, the first stage and stuff like that, is, in my opinion, making space interesting again. It's making it exciting again to watch these things happen.
Father, you're exactly right that the evolution of SpaceX, particularly the Falcon 9 Heavy launch with the Tesla, I was commentating that for ABC Radio in Australia Mm-hmm. And we had a call-in session afterwards. Somebody asked me, what does Elon Musk do now? And I said, get a bus to work. He's just launched his car. But yeah. the images of Starman sitting there in that cherry red Tesla with the Earth behind,
yeah,
that was such a powerful image, and it gave people something more than what they'd had previously from the space program. Mm-hmm. So that is why, one of the reasons why I say that watch Elon Musk. But the YouTube channel, as you rightly pointed out, everything is there. Their descriptions are just fantastic. Their on-screen information is brilliant. So, I back you with your pick 100%. It is a brilliant channel.
Yeah, so definitely check it out. If you got any interest at all in the space program, what SpaceX is doing and broadcasting is incredible. And their commentators are great because you both hear their radio chatter as they're doing all their checks and everything and as they're going along. But then they've got a commentator who comes on and explains, well, we're just about ready to go for, you know, main engine cutoff, or we're about ready to separate stage one. And this is going on, and this is what's happening. And it's so definitely check it out. If you're any at all interest of anything we talked about today, check out SpaceX's YouTube. Well, thank all of you for coming on. This was a phenomenal discussion, both of space and Australia. Thanks, Mac.
Don't thank me.
Yeah.
Thank our guests.
So, Scott, where can people hear more from you, find you?
Well, there's two ways you can do that. Firstly, I have my own website. It's www.orbitalprojects.net. Or else, keep an ear to the ABC Radio Listen Live website in Australia for ABC Hobart, and you may hear me pop up on there.
Excellent. Excellent. And Mac, how about you?
You can find me at Catholic in a Small Town. It's a podcast that my wife and I have been doing for 506 episodes now.
Wow.
And hopefully still going strong. We continue to make ourselves laugh through self-imposed marriage therapy. And we get to talk about the faith in the meantime. We've also launched a couple of new projects with Greg and Jennifer Willits of the Imperfect mm-hmm. Living podcast. We launched a new project for our patrons only right now called What We're Dealing With. So if you're a patron of their show or a patron of our show, patreon.com/CST. Then you can get that. And it is the most exciting thing that's happened to me on the podcast front in a long time. It is a wonderful, wonderful, energetic conversation for good people. Mm-hmm. Well, three good people and me talking about items that matter to our faith that we don't normally get to talk about in real life. Mm. That's great. And Greg and I are doing a show called Watch a Movie with Mac and Greg. The first episode just dropped the other day, where Greg and I sit and watch a movie together. And man, it's a lot of fun. We've watched Indiana Jones. We watched Rocky III the other day.
Nice.
It's such a trip down memory lane. Fantastic.
Well, why do I have a feeling Crocodile Dundee is going to end up on that list here pretty soon just because of this conversation?
That's a great idea.
Go for
Crikey.
It.
There we go.
Anything with the two of them is.
And Shelley, how about you?
Well, my sister and I keep a blog at www.soundmindandspirit, but more often you can see us on Facebook, and it's just at Sound Mind Spirit.
Excellent. And again, I'm Father Corey Stika. You can find my homilies at frcorey.org at my website. I'm on Facebook, Father Corey Stika. Fr Corey Stika is my Twitter handle, although I don't use that quite as much. But you can find me in those places usually. If you have feedback about this topic or any topic we've discussed in Let's Talk, you can send email to letstalk@sqpn.com, or you can comment on our SQPN Facebook page as well. We definitely see the comments there and can use that as feedback as well. So please do feel free to send us feedback. We definitely want to hear from you and what you think of everything that we do here at SQPN. Thank you very much for listening, and God bless.